it's difficult to live in a situation where you see constant injustice and not to want to change that in every way that you can.
The cycle of violence, as it's called, is only reported when Israelis are killed, once at least one Palestinian was being killed every day.
Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the self-same few, who wrung dollars out of blood in the war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, September 3rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that the United States was introducing a draft resolution to seek UN Security Council support for a multinational force for Iraq, in a step widely viewed as a significant change in U.S. strategy. But the draft being distributed to Security Council members today and tomorrow would keep such a United Nations force under American command, and the U.S. would continue to play a dominant role in the country, according to Powell. The White House, under intense pressure to defray the mounting human and financial cost of the Iraq occupation, nevertheless insisted today that it had not reversed course. "I disagree with that characterization," said Scott McClellan, the presidential spokesman. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat announced today that the peace process between Israel and Palestine is dead, and he blamed Israel for its demise. Speaking this afternoon at a press conference calling for an increased UN peacekeeping presence in Iraq, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell downplayed Arafat's announcement, calling him a, quote, irrelevant figure in the peace process, and stating that Arafat was not considered when the roadmap to peace was originally put together. Israel's defense minister, Shaul Mofaz, has said he is in favor of expelling Arafat, possibly by the end of the year, because Arafat was, quote, complicating moves toward peace. Peace Watch spoke recently with journalist and Middle East analyst Lamisa Doni about the current hostilities between Israel and Palestine. We began by asking her to respond to Mofaz's assertion.
Well, they're still acting as an occupation power, and I think both the U.S. and Israel are trying to fuel another. We're talking about civil war again among the Palestinians. It's like holding the Palestinian population hostage, that it's all the problem that you have Arafat, and if you get rid of him, everything will be all right. The sad thing, the Israelis have threatened to kill Arafat and to expel Arafat and even to kill him before. And the biggest problem now is that both Israel and the U.S., through their statements, have unfortunately succeeding in turning it into an internal Palestinian divide between the Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, and Arafat. That's the most dangerous part of the whole equation, because once you turn it into an internal conflict, then it makes it easier for Israel, as it's doing now, to continue building its racist wall, its apartheid wall, and as well as talking like this about expelling Arafat, even though with all of the criticism that you could have about Arafat, he's the elected leader of the Palestinian people. But it's another indication of how Israel and the U.S., and I will add the U.S., because the U.S. keeps on saying that we want, on one hand, Mofaz is threatening to expel Arafat, and he's saying that he is going to. On the other hand, the U.S. saying that it will not allow the collapse of the Mahmoud Abbas government, as if the government is representing the issues, represent the U.S. interests instead of the Palestinian people's interests. So both statements have the same meaning, that whoever leads the Palestinian people should do what we want. And that total denial of the right of representation for the Palestinian people, the right of self-determination for the Palestinian people, and dictating to the leaders of the Palestinian people what they should do, or they should be expelled. Mm. I think this is also a message to Abu Mazen, to the Prime Minister himself, is that you have to deliver or you wouldn't do, because there have been statements recently against even the Prime Minister himself. And unfortunately, many people are taking part in portraying the whole thing, and the internal conflict is giving credence and cover to such statements when Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas seems to be the moderate, between quotes, as portrayed by the U.S., and Arafat the opposite, article between quotes, then that gives cover to such statements. Mm-hmm. That gives cover to statements as outrageous and illegal. Illegal. This is an occupation power. It has no, Israel has no right to expel any Palestinian, let alone an elected leader, any Palestinian at all.
Do you think that Arafat is complicating or facilitating the movement of peace in that region?
Well, it depends what you mean by that. I mean, when the U.S. talks about a person complicating the movement to peace, it means really, we have to decipher this language. What it really means is that this person is not giving us everything and giving Israel everything it wants. He's not capitulating. They want total capitulation. First of all, Arafat has made many, 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 in my view, concessions to Israel, and he crossed many lines that the Palestinian people felt were compromising their own rights. However, that was not enough for either the U.S. or Israel, because what they want is to prevent for Israel to dictate its terms with no Palestinian resistance, be it peaceful or armed, because they even, as you know, they shoot at peaceful demonstrators and they deport and they shoot at even American and other Western peace activists. So I don't agree that Arafat is complicating even the American process of peace. Arafat's biggest mistake from the American viewpoint was that he did not accept the so-called offer at Camp David in 2000, which would have divided the West Bank and the Gaza Strip into five disconnected ghettos. And I want to tell people who are listening that Mahmoud Abbas was at Camp David, the prime minister, and he joined Arafat in refusing that. It wasn't just Arafat who refused that effort. Mahmoud Abbas himself refused it too.
Who has influence and sway over the Palestinian groups like Hamas that are violent in their actions?
Well, as you know, Arafat has more backing on the Palestinian street than the prime minister, by far. Mm-hmm. Partly due to his history, and partly due to the way the U.S. and Israel are treating Arafat, because people are reacting to that. But having said that, we have to remember that with Arafat's support, the prime minister did have talks with Hamas and all of the groups, and they agreed to a truce. And Israel was never adhered to the truce. They continued the assassinations, they continued the confiscating of lands, demolishing homes. While during the truce, it took more than 2 months before even Hamas reacted. So with the support of Arafat, the Palestinian group, including Hamas, not because of the leverage that the prime minister has on them, but because what's going on now in Palestine now is everybody from Hamas to Fatah, from the left to the right, from all groups, are worried of being dragged into a civil war. Today there was a statement in all of the Palestinian newspapers signed by all kinds of personalities, at least 217 activists and leaders, from people from the left to people like even Sarin Seba and Hana Ashrawi to people like Haider Abdeshafi, many people, everybody calling on Arafat and Abu Mazen to reach an agreement and calling on reaching a national consensus, because regardless of whatever of the differences they have with both men, the main concern now in Palestine is not to allow the U.S. statements and the Israeli threat to cause a civil war. This is why people are trying to get the two men together. People have legitimate criticism about both men, but the main priority now is to prevent civil war and not to allow Israel to take advantage of this conflict in order to provide cover for its actions, its continuous actions, and its statements like its expulsion of Arafat or anybody else. And because they're afraid that Israel will attack, there'll be an assault. As you know, the U.S. is depending on the Prime Minister Abu Mazen and Security Chief Mohammed Dahlan to crack down on the groups.
Mm-hmm.
Arafat, and to disarm Arafat from all of his powers, to strip Arafat from all of his powers. Arafat appointed Jibril Ejoub, another powerful security man, to face off Dahlan. And that made everybody nervous, because that means both of them have supporters inside the main Fatah group. Forget about Hamas. Because what people are afraid, it wouldn't start between Hamas and Fatah. It could start within Fatah itself.
Mm. Well,
and that's real civil war. That's a very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who is the leader of Hamas at this time?
Its mentor is still Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And there are different leaders like Israel estimated the most, between quotes, moderate voice, Ismail Abu Shanab, meaning the man who reached the agreement with Abu Mazen on the truth.
Mm-hmm.
With the Prime Minister, the man who was talking about reaching a national consensus with the Palestinian Authority, Israel assassinated him.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Israel did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have that radical, further radicalized, not only the supporters of Hamas and the rank and file of Hamas, but also the Palestinians who came out in the tens of thousands in his funeral. And that was a blow to both Arafat and Abu Mazen, although for a while it united both men because they felt that it reminded them of who the enemy is. The other thing, there is now Ismail Haniyeh, who is a very, very powerful man in Hamas, and also Dr. Abdelaziz Rantisi.
Mm-hmm.
And they are ready. They're saying that they're ready to have another truce,
mm-hmm.
to negotiate another truce.
Lamise, there was a truce initially, and then this cycle of violence began again. Since the bus bombing that killed 21 Israelis, Israel has killed 14 Palestinians, 11 Hamas members, and 3 bystanders, totaling 28 persons killed by Israel that we know of. What, in your opinion, will bring an end to this cycle of violence?
No, that's not accurate. The truce was broken long before that. I mean, long before the Jerusalem bombing. Because Israel did not stop going into the areas, the Palestinian towns, demolishing homes, killing activists from the first day of the truce. I mean,
never a truce, it sounds like what you're saying.
No. I mean, I think Hamas kept up the truce until then. But Israel never kept the truth. And this is the problem in the whole coverage. The cycle of violence, as it's called, is only reported when Israelis are killed. Once at least one Palestinian was being killed every day. This is average. At least 25 Palestinians were rounded up every day. That's on average. Other than the ones who were being, the homes that were demolished, the houses that were being confiscated to build the wall. So those were not counted at all. This is the problem with the whole understanding of the conflict. Once Israelis are killed, then the truce is broken. When the Palestinians are killed, when the Israeli army goes into Palestinian towns and kills people and demolish homes, this is not considered part of the truce. Many Hamas activists were being assassinated and were assassinated long before the bombing in Jerusalem. And the bombing of Jerusalem, of course, gave Israel the chance to and the pretext to go into Gaza and to have that. But it was estimating Hamas people and Fatah people and other people before then, throughout the so-called truce. So why wasn't that counted? You know, every day Palestinian officials and Palestinian opposition leaders were warning that Israel couldn't do that without it couldn't continue violating the truce without provoking attacks against it. Mm-hmm. And nobody was listening. And the other thing, they were totally marginalizing Arafat. And that was not being looked favorably upon in the Palestinian street at all.
And so now, what, in your opinion, is needs to happen in order to break this cycle of violence?
Well, in order to break it, there has to be a total Israeli commitment to stop the wall, to stop all of the settlements, to stop the demolitions, to abide by the Geneva Conventions. And for how can any Palestinian leader, be it Mahmoud Abbas or Arafat, and Arafat has more popularity on the street with all of his opponents, how could either of them negotiate anything, or both of them negotiate anything with any group, people like who are seen as pro-peace, who are favored by the U.S., like Sarin Sebi? He was leading a demonstration today against the wall because they are confiscating land from Jerusalem. They're confiscating land from every town. Today in the Palestinian newspapers, all of the pictures were of homes that were being demolished in order to build the wall, including a home of a man who was on his wedding day. He couldn't take his bride to his home because it was demolished for building the wall.
Okay.
And then Arafat and Abu Mazen go to the groups and tell them, you have to have a truce. Mm. They have to have something to offer to this group.
Lamise Andoni is a journalist and Middle East media analyst with the British newspaper Middle East International. She is originally from Palestine, but we reached her in Jordan. Last month, Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with Lucy Nusebi, the founder and director of MEND, Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy, and Mikhail Miller, an Israeli from the Truman Institute for Peace at Hebrew University. The two women are members of a 15-month traveling delegation of six Israeli and six Palestinian women committed to overcoming their differences through nonviolent social change. Their trip to D.C. was organized by the International Conflict Resolution Organization, Search for Common Ground. Nusebi and Miller stopped by Peace Watch's studios to discuss their experiences of working for change and their strategies for bridging the gaps that have divided their people for so many years.
I grew up in a Jewish community in Ohio, and I was raised in a community that was predominantly Jewish. It was a public school, but we celebrated Jewish holidays, and all of my friends were Jewish. And part of that culture was Israel. And when I was a child, they took me to Israel, and I saw the country. It was beautiful. I fell in love with it. And after high school, I went on a year program that was full of exciting adventures and real hard work, and it kind of solidified my relationship to the country. And when I had returned to the United States, I went to university, and I studied the closest thing that I could, which was the Middle East. And at that point, it had really become an active part of my adult life. I was involved in student activities at the university, and when I finished, I worked for a group that brought Israeli youth to the United States to travel and to talk to people. And at that point, I was actually supposed to go to the Peace Corps. And I met some people that said, well, why should you go to the Peace Corps? Why wouldn't you go to Israel? You're a nice Jewish girl. Jewish girls should go to Israel. And they found some work for me, and I went. And at that point, when I arrived in Israel, I began to work, and I realized that things were not as had they been presented to me. That I had been taught a myth, and I began my activism.
Could you elaborate a little bit? What types of things had you been taught, or what sort of notions had you been instilled with, and how was your experience different?
There was never a critical discussion about the formation of the State of Israel. The Jewish dream was always presented in a very one-sided way. We never discussed Palestinians. It wasn't an issue. There wasn't any question about what happened when the state was founded in 48. Never heard about it. And so these questions, once I start to realize that perhaps there was a whole nother side to the story, a narrative that I'd never heard, began to affect my ability to remain in the country with a citizenship that I got without having to make any effort whatsoever. And I felt a real commitment to that citizenship, that if I'm going to take this on, it's going to be part of my identity and part of my name, that I would have to work for it, and I'd have to work to improve the country and democracy and to make it livable for everybody who's there.
Were there any particular experiences you had or Palestinians you had met that sort of opened your...
No, it wasn't any kind of overnight realization. I didn't have an epiphany. It was more that, you know, I'm curious and interested, and I moved to Jerusalem. And at that point, I started to look around and ask questions, get involved. And I was studying my master's degree in the university, and I wasn't even liking what I was hearing. And I didn't like the attitudes I was hearing from the students. And it didn't make sense to me that it could be just this simple. And that was pretty much what sparked it.
Lucy Nasebi, you grew up in the United Kingdom. You went to Oxford. You're not a Palestinian, but you consider yourself part of the Palestinian community. You currently live in occupied Jerusalem, and you've married a Palestinian. How did all of this come about?
I met my husband at Oxford. We were both undergraduates there together, and I've known him since I was 19. And it was always clear that he wanted to move back to Jerusalem. He's from one of the oldest Palestinian families in Jerusalem. They're actually so old and so respected that they're a Muslim family who hold the key to the Christian church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is something that they've done maybe for 1,000 years or more. And so they're a family with very, very deep roots in Jerusalem. My father-in-law had been very active in politics. So it was always clear, even before we were married, that my husband would be coming back and living and working in Jerusalem. So I, from when we were first together, started to get involved and interested in what was going on. And I took a degree in Middle East Studies at Harvard while my husband was doing a PhD there. And when we went back to live, we were both teaching in Birzeit University, which at the time was considered a hotbed of Palestinian nationalism. It was actually a very, very alive and exciting place to work and to teach. We were teaching history of ideas and philosophy, which was a compulsory course. So we got to know a very, very wide range of the student population. And from that, it was natural to start to really want to work to change things from the better. It's difficult to live in a situation where you see constant injustice and not to want to change that in every way that you can. So I started to get more and more involved.
How long have you been living in Jerusalem now?
I've lived there since 1978. Mm. That's 25 years. It's a long time.
Yeah.
I have grown-up children who consider themselves Palestinian.
How has the political and social climate changed over the years?
In some ways, it's better, and in many ways, it's much worse. Mm-hmm. When I first lived there, there was much more freedom of movement, obviously. It was an open country, but at the same time, there was a lot of harassment, and the occupation was much less visible than it is now. Now people's life is unlivable. For most Palestinians, the day-to-day sufferings and the impossibility of living a normal life dominate in every way. Many people spend time, for instance, days under curfew, which is not like a curfew in the United States. It's a 24-hour curfew where you're not allowed out of your house. There are Israeli jeeps that drive around and yell that anyone who is seen outside will be shot. And people have been shot and killed even just for getting too close to a window. So this is part of the reality that Palestinians now have to live with. And I have lived through curfews of this kind. It's a situation where many people now are in despair and desperate for any way to get out of the appalling living conditions, and where they want a way to get a life back. The economy is in tatters. The unemployment levels are now over 80% in most areas. People are really suffering from malnutrition. The levels, according to some reports, are higher even than in countries like Bangladesh. So this is shocking. This is a result not of natural disasters, but of man-made disaster. And it's time that people changed this. I think the current roadmap, for all that it may not be perfect, is at least giving people some kind of hope. The other thing that I think is a cause for hope is a really significant increase in interest among the Palestinian population in nonviolent resistance, in working to demilitarize the situation and find nonviolent ways to reach a just solution. I think this is the most significant and important development in the last year and a half. And this is partly because the situation is so terrible, but it is something that I think should be worked with and that can be worked with, and that I would like the international community to be aware of, that the majority of Palestinians are nonviolent and are now interested in working with nonviolence.
You consider yourself a part of the Palestinian community, but you yourself obviously weren't born Palestinian. What is it like living in occupied Jerusalem as a originally a British citizen?
Well, obviously it's a little bit different because I have a British passport. It doesn't enable me to move particularly freely, but I think it does give me perhaps an extra sense of protection, whereas I'm aware that Palestinians who are at the mercy of the Israeli occupation forces more than I am, and it's not easy for anyone. It's a very, very difficult situation to move in, to live in. There are risks, even as a foreigner, one takes risks. I have perhaps an advantage or a disadvantage by being a foreigner as well, because I also go to West Jerusalem. And so I can understand perhaps some of the Israeli fears better than people who don't go to the other side. I can identify, I think, perhaps better than many with the problems of both peoples in this horrible conflict.
I'd like to support what Lucy's been saying, but I think that there's something that needs to be added here, that the asymmetry in the relationship between the State of Israel and the Palestinian people is also seen in this this aspect of life as well. That there is a tremendous amount of suffering going on the Palestinian side that is incomprehensible to anybody who has not witnessed it or even experienced it themselves. But on the other hand, the Israelis are now starting to recognize that there is a real cost to the Israelis as well, not only to the economy, but to the moral fabric of the society. It's collapsing. The Israeli economy is on the is really going to a point where the unemployment is soaring. The rates are higher now than they have been ever. That the banking system is going through all kinds of problems. Everything is going wrong, and is a direct relation to what is happening. It's a result of the occupation, and Israel has not yet begun to talk about this. It's not yet on the table of the people who are making the decisions, and the average people in their homes who haven't really understood what occupation means. It hasn't spoken to them yet, and so part of what we do is try to get the message out to people that occupation is not just the problem of the Palestinians, but is the problem of the Israelis. I liked how Lucy had answered the question about having multiple identities in this region, because it is very complex. And I also have another identity. I do integrate into Israeli society, but I also can move freely. I can also call on my American accent and language and demeanor when I want to. And it does permit me to have access to people in places that I wouldn't have as an Israeli.
Mikhail Miller is an active member of Maxim Watch, a women's organization that monitors human rights at military checkpoints in the West Bank. We'll continue Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian's conversation with her and Lucy Nusebi of Middle East Nonviolence and Democracy after this short break.